Side 8. Domes of Fire. The Tomoli, Book 1. By David Eddings. Continuing on page 286.
I think it's time we got you out of Sarsos. Some of the local opinions are starting to cloud your thinking.
Really? Her tone was dangerous.
It's very easy to dismiss any sort of animosity as simple prejudice, and that's the worst form of sloppy thinking. There are other reasons for disliking people, too, you know.
Do you remember Sir Antus?
She nodded. I absolutely hated that man.
Antus? I thought he was your friend.
I couldn't stand him. My hands started to shake every time he came near me.
Would you believe I was actually happy when Martell killed him? Sparhawk!
You don't need to share that with Vanyan, little mother. I'm not very proud of it. What I'm trying to say is that people sometimes hate us for personal reasons that have nothing at all to do with our race or class or anything else. Ilana probably dislikes Zelasta just because she dislikes him. Maybe she doesn't like the way his eyebrows jut out. You should always consider the simplest explanation before you go looking for something exotic.
Is there anything else about me you'd like to change, Sir Knight?
He looked her up and down gravely. You're really very small, you know. Have you ever considered growing just a bit? She almost retorted, but then she suddenly laughed.
You can be the most disarming man in the world, Sparhawk.
I know. That's why people love me so much.
Now do you see why I'm so fond of these great Aline oafs?
Sophronia said lightly to her sister.
Of course,
Afriel replied.
It's because they're like big, clumsy puppies.
Her dark eyes grew serious.
Not too many people know who I really am, she mused. You two and Vanyan are about the only ones who recognize me in this incarnation. I think it might be a good idea if we kept it that way. Our enemy, whoever he is, might make a slip or two if he doesn't know I'm around.
You'll want to tell Zelasta, though, won't you?
Sophronia asked her.
Not yet, I don't think. He doesn't really need to know, so let's just keep it to ourselves.
When you trust someone, you're putting yourself in the position of also trusting everybody he trusts, and sometimes that includes people you don't even know. I'd rather not do that just yet.
She's growing very skilled at logic, Sparhawk observed.
I know, Sophronia sighed. She's fallen in with evil companions, I'm afraid.
They left Sarsos later that morning, riding out through the East Gate, to be joined by the Church Knights, the Paloi, and Engessa's two legions of Aetons. The day was fair and warm, and the sky intensely blue. The newly risen sun stood above the range of jagged snow-capped peaks lying to the east. The peaks reared upward, and their soaring flanks were wrapped in the deep blue shadows of morning. The country lying ahead looked wild and rugged. Engessa was striding along beside Sparhawk, and his bronze face had a somewhat softer expression than it normally wore. He gestured toward the peaks.
Aetan, Sparhawk Knight, he said. My homeland.
A significant-looking country, Aetan Engessa, Sparhawk approved. How long have you been away?
15 years.
That's a long exile.
It is indeed, Sparhawk Knight.
Engessa glanced back at the carriage rolling along behind them. Zelasta had supplanted Stragan, and Mirtai, her face serene, sat holding Danae on her lap.
We know each other, do we not, Sparhawk Knight?
The Aetan said. I'd say so, Sparhawk agreed. Our people have many different customs, but we seem to have stepped around most of those. Engessa smiled slightly.
You conducted yourself well during our discussions concerning Aetan and Mirtai, and Domi Kring.
Reasonable men can usually find reasons to get along with each other.
Alines set great store in reason, do they not?
It's one of our quirks, I suppose.
I'll explain something about one of our customs to you, Sparhawk Knight. I may not say it too clearly, because I am clumsy in your language. I'll rely on you to explain it to the others.
I'll do my very best, Aetan Engessa.
Aetan Mirtai will will go through the rite of passage while she is in Aton.
I was fairly sure she would.
It is the custom of our people for the child to relive the memories of childhood before the rite, and it is important for her family to be present while that is done. I have spoken with Aton Amirtai, and her childhood was not happy. Many of her memories will be painful, and she will need those who love her near while she sets them aside. Will you tell Aelana Queen and the others what is happening?
I will, Engessa Aton.
The Aetana will come to you when she is ready. It is her right to choose those who will support her. Some of her choices may surprise you, but among my people it is considered an honor to be chosen.
We will look upon it so, Engessa Aton.
Sparhawk briefly advised the others that Mirtai would be calling a meeting at a time of her own choosing, but he did not go into too much detail, since he himself did not know exactly what to expect. That evening, the Aton giantess moved quietly through the camp, her manner uncharacteristically diffident. She did not, as they might have expected, peremptorily command them to attend, but rather she asked, one might almost say pleaded, and her eyes were very vulnerable. Most of her choices were the ones Sparhawk would have expected. They were the people who had been closest to Mirtai during her most recent enslavement. There were some surprises, however. She invited a couple of Pandions Sparhawk had not even known she was acquainted with, as well as a couple of Kryns Poloi and two Aton girls from Engessa's legions. She also asked Emban and Oscania to hear her story. They gathered around a large fire that evening, and Engessa spoke briefly to them before Mirtai began.
It is customary among our people for one to put childhood away before entering adulthood, he told them gravely. Aetana Mirtai will participate in the rite of passage soon, and she has asked us to be with her as she sets the past aside. He paused, and his tone became reflective. This child is not like other Aton children, he told them. For most, the childhood that is put away is simple, and much like that of all others of our race. Aetana Mirtai, however, returns from slavery. She has survived that, and has returned to us. Her childhood has been longer than most, and has contained things not usual, painful things. We will listen with love, even though we do not always understand. He turned to Mirtai. It might be well to begin with the place where you were born, my daughter, he suggested. Yes, Father Aton, she replied politely.
Since Engessa had assumed the role of parent when they had first met, Mirtai's response was traditionally respectful. Now she spoke in a subdued voice that reflected none of her customary assertiveness. Sparhawk had the distinct impression that they were suddenly seeing a different Mirtai, a gentle, rather sensitive girl who had been hiding behind a brusque exterior.
I was born in a village lying to the west of Dirges, she began, near the headwaters of the river Sarna.
She spoke in Alenic, since, with the exception of Oscania, Engessa, and the two Aton girls, none of her loved ones spoke Tamil.
We lived deep in the mountains. My mother and father made much of that.
She smiled faintly.
All Aetons believe that they're special, but we mountain Aetons believe that we're especially special. We're obliged to be the very best at everything we do, since we're so obviously superior to everybody else.
She gave them all a rather sly glance. Mirtai was very observant, and her offhand remark tweaked the collective noses of Styrek and Aline alike.
I spent my earliest years in the forests and mountains. I walked earlier than most, and ran almost as soon as I could walk. My father was very proud of me, and he often said that I was born running. As is proper, I tested myself often. By the time I was 5, I could run for half a day, and at 6, from dawn until sunset. The children of our village customarily entered training very late, usually when we were nearly 8, because the training camp in our district was very far away,
and our parents did not want to be completely separated from us while we were still babies. Mountain Etons are very emotional. It's our one failing.
Were you happy, Etana? Engesa asked her gently.
Very happy, Father Etan, she replied. My parents loved me, and they were very proud of me. Ours was a small village with only a few children. I was the best, and my parents' friends all made much of me.
She paused, and her eyes filled with tears.
And then the Arjunai slavers came. They were armed with bows. They were only interested in the children, so they killed all of the adults. My mother was killed with the first arrow.
Her voice broke at that point, and she lowered her head for a moment. When she raised her face, the tears were streaming down her cheeks. Gravely, Princess Danae went to her and held out her arms. Without apparently even thinking about it, Mirtai lifted the little girl up into her lap. Danae touched her tear-wet cheek and then softly kissed her.
I didn't see my father die, Mirtai continued. Her voice was choked, but then it rang out, and her tear-filled eyes hardened. I killed the first Arjunai who tried to capture me. They're ignorant people who can't seem to realize that children can be armed, too. The Arjunai was holding a sword in his right hand, and he took my arm with his left. My dagger was very sharp, and it went in smoothly when I stabbed him under the arm with it. The blood came out of his mouth like a fountain. He fell back, and I stabbed him again, up under his breastbone this time. I could feel his heart quivering on the point of my knife. I twisted the blade, and he died.
Yes! Kring half-shouted.
The Domi was weeping openly, and his voice was hoarse and savage.
I tried to run, Mirtai went on, but another Arjunai kicked my feet out from under me and tried to grab my dagger. I cut the fingers off his right hand and stabbed him low in the belly. It took him 2 days to die, and he screamed the whole time. His screams comforted me.
Yes!
It was Kalton this time, and his eyes were also tear-filled. The Etan girl gave him a brief, sad smile.
The Arjunai saw that I was dangerous, so they knocked me senseless. When I woke up, I was in chains.
This all happened when you were only 8?
Elana asked the giantess in a half-whisper.
7, Elana, Mirtai corrected gently. I wasn't yet 8.
You actually killed a man at that age?
Emban asked her incredulously.
2 Emban. The one who screamed for 2 days also died.
The Etana looked at Engesa, her glistening eyes a bit doubtful.
May I claim that one as well, Father Etan? She asked. He might have died anyway of something else.
You may claim him, my daughter, he judged. It was your knife thrust that killed him. She sighed.
I've always wondered about that one, she confessed. It clouded my count, and I didn't like that.
It was a legitimate kill, Etana. Your count is unclouded.
Thank you, Father Etan, she said. It's a bad thing to be uncertain about so important a matter.
She paused, collecting her memories.
I didn't kill again for almost half a year. The Arjunai took me south to Tiana. I did not cry at all during the journey. It is not proper to let your enemies see you grieve. At Tiana, my captors took me to the slave market and sold me to a Dakite merchant named Pelazer. He was fat and greasy, he smelled bad, and he was fond of children.
He was a kindly master, then?
Baroness Melodir asked her.
I didn't say that, Melodir. Pelazer liked little boys and girls in a rather peculiar way. The Arjunai had warned him about me, so he wouldn't let me near any knives. I had to eat, however, so he gave me a spoon. He took me to his home at Varel in Daconia, and I spent the entire journey sharpening the handle of my spoon on my chains. It was a good metal spoon, and it took a very fine edge. When we got to Varel, he chained me to the wall in the little room at the back of his house. The room had a stone floor, and I spent all my time working on my spoon. I grew very fond of it,
She bent slightly and slid her hand down into her boot.
"Isn't it pretty?"
The implement she held up was a very ordinary-looking spoon with a wooden handle. She took it in both hands, twisted the handle slightly, and then pulled it off the shank of the spoon. The shank was thin and narrow, and it came to a needle-like point. It had been polished until it gleamed like silver. She looked at it critically.
"It's not quite long enough to reach a man's heart,"
she apologized for her spoon.
"You can't kill cleanly with it, but it's good for emergencies. It looks so much like an ordinary spoon that nobody ever thinks to take it away from me."
"Brilliant," Stragan murmured, his eyes glowing with admiration. "Steal us a couple of spoons, Talon, and we'll get to work on them immediately."
"Palazar came to my room one night and put his hands on me," Mirtai continued. "I sat very still, and so he thought I wouldn't resist. He started to smile. I noticed that he drooled when he smiled like that. He was still smiling and drooling when I stabbed both of his eyes out. Did you know that a man's eyes pop when you poke them with something sharp?"
Melodir made a slightly gagging sound and stared at the calm-faced Etana in open horror.
"He tried to scream,"
Mirtai went on in a chillingly clinical way,
"but I looped my chain around his neck to keep him quiet. I really wanted to cut him into little pieces, but I had to hold the chain in both hands to keep him from screaming. He began to struggle, but I just pulled the chain tighter about his neck."
"Yes!"
Rather astonishingly, it was Elana's doe-eyed maid, Aileen, who cried her hoarse approval, and the quick embrace she gave the startled Etana was uncharacteristically fierce. Mirtai touched the gentle girl's face fondly, and then continued.
"Palazar struggled quite a bit at first, but after a while he stopped. He had knocked over the candle, and the room was dark, so I couldn't be sure he was dead. I kept the chain pulled tight around his neck until morning. His face was very black when the sun came up."
"A fair kill, my daughter," Engesa said to her proudly.
She smiled and bowed her head to him.
"I thought they would kill me when they discovered what I had done. But the Dakites of the southern towns are peculiar people. Palazar wasn't well liked in Varel, and I think many of them were secretly amused by the fact that one of the children he usually molested had finally killed him. His heir was a nephew named Gellin. He was very grateful that I'd made him rich by killing his uncle, and he spoke to the authorities in my behalf."
She paused and looked at the princess, who was still nestled in her lap holding the gleaming little dagger.
"Could you get me some water, Danae?"
she asked.
"I'm not used to talking so much."
Danae obediently slipped down and went over toward one of the cooking fires.
"She might be a little young to hear about certain things,"
Mirtai murmured.
"Gellin was a rather nice young man, but he had peculiar tastes. He gave his love to other young men instead of women."
Sir Bevier gasped.
"Oh, dear,"
Mirtai said.
"Are you truly that unworldly, Bevier? It's not uncommon, you know. Anyway, I got on quite well with Gellin. At least he didn't try to take advantage of me. He loved to talk, so he taught me to speak Elenic, and even to read a bit. People in his circumstances lead rather tentative lives, and he needed a permanent friend. I had been taught that it was polite to listen when my elders spoke, and after a time he would pour out his heart to me. When I grew a little older, he bought me pretty gowns to wear, and sometimes he'd even wear them himself, although I think he was only joking. Some of his friends wore women's clothes, but nobody was really very serious about it. It's something they laughed about. It was about then that I started to go through that difficult time in a girl's life when she starts to become a woman. He was very gentle and understanding, and he explained what was happening so that I wasn't afraid. He used to have me wear my prettiest gowns, and he'd take me with him when he was doing business with people who didn't know his preferences. Deconia is an Aline kingdom, and Alines have some peculiar ideas about that sort of thing. They try to mix religion into it for some reason. Anyway, the fact that Gellin always had a young slave girl with him quieted suspicions."
Bevier's eyes had a stunned look in them.
Maybe you should go to help the princess look for that water, Bevier,
Mirtai suggested to him almost gently.
This was a part of my childhood, so I have to talk about it at this time. You don't have to listen if it bothers you, though. I'll understand.
His face grew troubled.
I'm your friend, Mirtai, he declared. I'll stay.
She smiled.
He's such a nice boy. She said it in almost the same tone of voice Sophronia had always used when saying exactly the same thing. Sparhawk was a bit startled at how shrewdly perceptive the Eitan girl really was.
Mirtai sighed.
Gellin and I loved each other, but not in the way that people usually think of when they're talking about a man and a woman. There are as many different kinds of love as there are people, I think. He had enemies, though. Many enemies. He was a very sharp trader, and he almost always got the best of every bargain. There are small people in the world who take that sort of thing personally. Once, an Edomish merchant became so enraged that he tried to kill Gellin, and I had to use my spoon to protect him. As I said before, the blade's not quite long enough to kill cleanly, so the incident was very messy. I ruined a very nice silk gown that evening. I told Gellin that he really ought to buy me some proper knives, so that I could kill people without spoiling my clothes. The idea of having a 12-year-old girl for a bodyguard startled him at first, but then he saw the advantages of it. He bought me these.
She touched one of the silver-hilted daggers at her waist.
I've always treasured them. I devised a way to conceal them under my clothes when we went out into the city. After I'd used them on a few people, the word got around, and his enemies quit trying to kill him. There were other young men like Gellin and Varel, and they used to visit each other in their homes, where they didn't have to hide their feelings. They were all very kind to me. They used to give me advice and buy me pretty gifts. I was quite fond of them. They were all polite and intelligent, and they always smelled clean. I can't abide smelly men.
She gave Kring a meaningful look. I bathe, he protested.
Now and then,
she added a bit critically.
You ride horses a great deal, Kring, and horses have a peculiar odor. We'll talk about regular bathing after I've put my brand on you.
She laughed.
I wouldn't want to frighten you until I'm sure of you.
Her smile was genuinely affectionate. Sparhawk realized that what she was telling them was a part of the rite of passage, and that she would very likely never be this open again. Her typically Eitan defenses had all been lowered for this one night. He felt profoundly honored to have been invited to be present. She sighed then, and her face grew sad.
Gellin had one very special friend whom he loved very much, a pretty young fellow named Magin. I didn't like Magin. He used to take advantage of Gellin, and he'd deliberately say and do things to hurt him. He was frivolous and selfish, and very, very vain about his appearance. He was also unfaithful, and that's contemptible. In time, he grew tired of Gellin, and fell in love with another meaningless, pretty boy. I probably should have killed them both as soon as I found out about it. I've always regretted the fact that I didn't. Gellin had foolishly given Magin the use of a rather splendid house on the outskirts of Varel, and had told him that he'd make provisions in his will, so that Magin would own the house if anything ever happened to him. Magin and his new friend wanted that house, and they plotted against Gellin. They lured him to the house one night, and insisted that he come to them alone. When he got there, they killed him and dropped his body in the river. I cried for days after it happened, because I was really very fond of Gellin. One of his other friends told me what had really happened, but I didn't say anything or do anything right away. I wanted the two of them to feel safe, and to think that they'd gotten away with the murder. Gellin's sister inherited me, along with all his other property. She was a nice enough lady, but awfully religious. She didn't really know how to deal with the fact that she owned me. She said she wanted to be my friend, but I advised her to sell me instead. I told her that I'd found out who had murdered Gellin, and that I was going to kill them. I said that I thought it would probably be better if I belonged to somebody who was leaving Varel,
in order to avoid all the tedious business about unexplained bodies and the like. I thought she'd be tiresome about it, but she took it rather well. She was really quite fond of her brother, and she approved of what I was planning. She sold me to an Aline merchant, who was going to sail to Vardenay, and told him that she'd deliver me to him on the morning of his departure. She'd made him a very good price, so he didn't argue with her. Anyway, on the night before my new owner was planning to sail, I dressed myself as a boy and went to the house where Madgen and the other one were living. I waited until Madgen left the house and went to the door and knocked. Madgen's new friend came to the door, and I told him that I loved him. I'd lived with Gellin for 6 years, so I knew exactly how to behave to make the pretty fool believe me. He grew excited when I told him that, and he kissed me several times. She sneered with profoundest contempt. Some people simply cannot be faithful. Anyway, after he began to get very, very excited with the kissing, he started exploring. He discovered some things that surprised him very much. He was even more surprised when I sliced him across the belly just above his hips.
"I like this part," Talon said, his eyes very bright.
"You would," Mirtai told him. "You never like a story unless there's a lot of blood in it. Anyway, after I sliced the pretty boy open, all sorts of things fell out. He stumbled back into a chair and tried to stuff them back in again. People's insides are very slippery, though, and he was having a great deal of trouble."
Elana made a choking sound.
"Didn't you know about insides?" Mirtai asked her. "Get Sparhawk to tell you about it sometime. He's probably seen lots of insides." I left the young man sitting there and hid behind a door. Madgen came home a while later, and he was dreadfully upset about his friend's condition.
"I can imagine," Talon laughed.
"He was even more upset, though, when I reached around from behind him and opened him up in exactly the same way."
"Those are not fatal injuries, Etana," Engessa said critically.
"I didn't intend for them to be, Father Eitan," she replied. "I wasn't done with the two of them yet. I told them who I was, and that what I'd just done to them was a farewell gift from Gellin. That was about the best part of the whole evening. I put Madgen in a chair facing the chair of his friend, so that they could watch each other die. Then I stuck my hands into them and jerked out several yards of those slippery things I told you about."
"And then you just left them there?" Talon asked eagerly.
She nodded. "Yes, but I set fire to the house first. Neither Madgen or his friend managed to get enough of themselves put back inside to be able to escape. They screamed a great deal, though."
"Good God!" Amban choked.
"A fitting revenge, Etana," Engessa said to her. "We will describe it to the children in the training camps, to provide them with an example of suitable behavior."
Mirtai bowed her head to him, then looked up. "Well, Bevier," she said. He struggled with it. "Your owner's sins were his own. That's a matter between him and God. What you did was the proper act of a friend. I find no sin in what you did."
"I'm so glad," she murmured.
Bevier laughed a bit sheepishly. "That was a bit pompous, wasn't it?" "That's all right, Bevier," she assured him. "I love you anyway, although you should keep in mind the fact that I have a history of loving some very strange people."
"Well said," Ulath approved.
Danae returned with a cup of water and offered it to Mirtai.
"Did you finish telling them the things you didn't want me to hear about?" she asked.
"I think I covered most of it. Thank you for being so understanding, and for the water."
Nothing rattled Mirtai. Elana, however, blushed furiously.
"It's getting late," Mirtai told them, "so I'll keep this short. The Aline merchant who owned me took me to Vardenay and sold me to Platamy. I pretended not to speak Alenic, and Platamy misjudged my age because I was very tall. Platamy's quite shrewd in some ways and ignorant in others. He simply couldn't understand the fact that an Etan woman can't be forced, and he tried to put me to work in one of his brothels. He took my daggers away from me, but I still had my spoon. I didn't kill too many of the men who approached me, but I did hurt them all quite seriously. Word got around, and the business in that brothel fell off. Platamy took me out of there, but he didn't really know what to do with me. I wouldn't beg, and I wouldn't steal, and he was really very disappointed when he found out that I'd only kill people for personal reasons. I won't be a paid assassin. Then the situation came up in the palace, and he gave me to Elana, probably with a great sigh of relief. She frowned and looked at Engesa. That was the first time I'd ever been given away instead of sold, Father Eitan. Did Platamy insult me? Should I go back to Samura and kill him? Engesa considered it.
I don't think so, my daughter. It was a special case. You might even look upon it as a compliment.
Mirtai smiled. I'm glad of that, Father Eitan. I sort of like Platamy. He's very funny sometimes.
And how do you feel about Elana, Queen?
I love her. She's ignorant, and she can't speak a proper language, but most of the time she does what I tell her to do. She's pretty, and she smells nice, and she's very kind to me. She's the best owner I've ever had. Yes, I love her.
Elana gave a low cry and threw her arms around the golden woman's neck.
I love you too, Mirtai, she said in an emotion-filled voice. You're my dearest friend.
She kissed her.
This is a special occasion, Elana, the Eitana said. So it's all right just this once.
She gently detached the queen's arms from around her neck.
But it's not seemly to display so much emotion in public, and girls shouldn't kiss other girls. It might give people the wrong sort of ideas.
Chapter 19 Hang it all, Eitan and Gessa, Kalton was saying. You heard the story the same as the rest of us. She said she hadn't even entered training when the Arjunai captured her. Where did she learn to fight the way she does? I've been training more or less constantly since Sparhawk and I were 15, and she throws me around like a rag doll any time she feels like it. And Gessa smiled slightly. It was still very early, and a filmy morning mist drifted ghost-like among the trees, softening the dark outlines of their trunks. They had set out at dawn, and Engesa strode along among the mounted pandions.
"I've seen you in a fight, Kalton Knight," the tall Eitan said. He reached out and rapped one knuckle on Kalton's armor. "Your tactics depend heavily on your equipment."
"That's true, I suppose."
"And your training has concentrated on the use of that equipment, has it not?"
Well, to some degree, I suppose. We practice with our weapons and learn to take advantage of our armor. And the sheer bulk of our horses, Vanyan added.
Vanyan was wearing his black armor for the journey. Before their party had even left Sarsos, Vanyan's choice of wardrobe had occasioned a spirited discussion between him and the woman he loved. Once she had removed herself from the restraining presence of all those Alines, Sophrenia had become more vocal, and she had shown an astonishing aptitude for histrionics during the course of the conversation. Although she and Vanyan had been talking privately, Sparhawk had been able to hear her comments quite clearly. Everyone in the house had heard her. Probably everyone in Sarsos had.
"At least half of your training has been in horsemanship, Kalton," Vanyan continued. "An armored knight without his horse is very much like a turtle on his back."
"I've said much the same thing to my fellow novices, Lord Vanyan," Khalad said politely. "Most of them take offense when I say it to them, though, so I usually have to demonstrate. That seems to offend them even more for some reason."
And Engesa chuckled.
"You train with your equipment, Kalton Knight," he repeated. "So do we. The difference is that our bodies are our equipment. Our way of fighting is based on speed, agility, and strength. And we can practice those without training grounds or large fields where horses can run. We practice all the time, and in the village where she was born, Eitana Mirtai saw her parents and their friends improving their skills almost every hour. Children learn by imitating their parents. We see 3- and 4-year-olds wrestling and testing each other all the time."
"There has to be more to it than that," Kalton objected.
Natural talent, perhaps, Sir Calton? Barrett suggested.
I'm not that clumsy, Barrett.
Was your mother a warrior, Calton Knight? Engessa asked him.
Of course not.
Or your grandmother? Or your grandmother's grandmother? Back for 50 generations? Calton looked confused. Etana Myrtai is descended from warriors on both sides of her family. Fighting is in her blood. She is gifted, and she can learn much just by watching. She can probably fight in a half dozen different styles.
That's an interesting notion, Etan Engessa, Vanyan said. If we could find a horse big enough for her, she might make a very good knight. Vanyan, Calton exclaimed, that's the most unnatural suggestion I've ever heard. Merely speculation, Calton.
Vanyan looked gravely at Sparhawk.
We might want to give some thought to including a bit more hand-to-hand fighting in our training program, Preceptor Sparhawk. Please, don't do that, Vanyan, Sparhawk replied in a pained tone. You're still the preceptor until the hierocracy says otherwise. I'm just the interim preceptor. All right, interim preceptor Sparhawk. When we get to Aton, let's pay some attention to their fighting style. We don't always fight on horseback, you know.
I'll put Khalad to work on it, Sparhawk said.
Khalad?
Kurek trained him, and Kurek was better at close fighting than any other man I've ever known.
He was indeed. Good idea, interim preceptor Sparhawk.
Must you? Sparhawk asked him. They reached the city of Etana 12 days later. At least it seemed like 12 days. Sparhawk had decided to stop brooding about the difference between real and perceived time. Afriel was going to tamper no matter what he did or said anyway, so why should he waste time worrying about it? He wondered if Zelasta could detect the manipulation. Probably not, he decided. No matter how skilled the Styric magician might be, he was still only a man, and Afriel was divine. An odd thought came to Sparhawk one night, however. He wondered if his daughter could also make real time seem faster than it actually was, instead of slower. After he thought about it for a while, though, he decided not to ask her. The whole concept gave him a headache. Etana was a utilitarian sort of town in a deep green valley. It was walled, but the walls were not particularly high nor imposing. It was the Etans themselves who made their capital impregnable.
Everything in the kingdom's named Etan, isn't it? Calton observed as they rode down into the valley. The kingdom, its capital, the people, even the titles.
I think Etan's more in the nature of a concept than a name. Ulof shrugged.
What makes them all so tall? Talon asked. They belong to the Tamil race, but other Tamils don't loom over everybody else like trees.
Oskanya explained it to me, Stregan told him. It seems that the Etans are the result of an experiment.
Magic?
I don't know all that much about it, Stregan admitted. But I'd guess that what they did went beyond what magic's capable of. Back before there was even such a thing as history, the Etans observed that big people win more fights than little people. That was in a time when parents chose the mates of their children. Size became the most important consideration.
What happened to short children? Talon objected.
Probably the same thing that happens to ugly children in our society.
Stregan shrugged.
They didn't get married.
That's not fair.
Stregan smiled.
When you get right down to it, Talon, it's not really very fair when we steal something somebody else has worked for, is it?
That's different.
Stregan leaned back in his saddle and laughed. Then he went on.
The Etans prized other characteristics as well. Ability, strength, aggressiveness, and homicidal vindictiveness. It's strange how the combination worked out. If you stop and think about it, you'll realize that Myrtai is really a rather sweet girl. She's warm and affectionate. She really cares about her friends, and she's strikingly beautiful. She's got certain triggers built into her, though. And when somebody trips one of those triggers, she starts killing people. The Etan breeding program finally went too far, I guess. the Etons became so aggressive that they started killing each other. And since such aggressiveness can't be restricted to one sex, the women were as bad as the men. It got to the point that there was no such thing in Etan as a mild disagreement. They'd kill each other over weather predictions. He smiled. Oskanya told me that the world discovered just how savage Etan women were in the 12th century. A large band of Arjunai slavers attacked a training camp for adolescent Etan females. The sexes are separated during training in order to avoid certain complications. Anyway, those half-grown Etan girls, most of them barely over 6 feet tall, slaughtered most of the Arjunai and then sold the rest to the Tamils as eunuchs.
The slavers were eunuchs?
Kaltan asked with some surprise. No, Kaltan, Strakin explained patiently. They weren't eunuchs until after the girls captured them.
Little girls did that?
Kaltan's expression was one of horror. They weren't exactly babies, Kaltan. They were old enough to know what they were doing. Anyway, the Etons had a very wise king in the 15th century. He saw that his people were on the verge of self-destruction. He made contact with the Tamil government and surrendered his people into perpetual slavery to save their lives. A little extreme, Ulaf noted. There are several kinds of slavery, Ulaf. Here in Etan, it's institutionalized. The Tamils tell the Etons where to go and whom to kill, and they can usually find a reason to deny petitions by individual Etons to slaughter each other. That's about as far as it really goes. It's a good working arrangement. The Etan race survives, and the Tamils get the finest infantry in the world. Talon was frowning.
The Etons are terribly impressed with size, you said.
Well, it's one of the things that impresses them, Strakin amended.
Then why did Mirtai agree to marry Kring?
Kring's a good warrior,
but he's not much taller than I am, and I'm still growing.
It must be something else about him that impressed her so much, Strakin shrugged.
What do you think it is?
I haven't got the faintest idea, Talon.
He's a poet, Sparhawk told them. Maybe that's it.
That wouldn't make that much difference to someone like Mirtai, would it? She did slice two men open and then burn them alive, remember? She doesn't sound to me like the kind of girl who'd get all gushy about poetry.
Don't ask me, Talon, Strakin laughed. I know a great deal about the world, but I wouldn't even try to make a guess about why any woman chooses any given man.
Good thinking, Ulaf murmured.
The city had been alerted to their approach by Ngesa's messengers, and the royal party was met at the gate by a deputation of towering Etons in formal attire, which in their culture meant the donning of unadorned, ankle-length cloaks of dark wool. In the midst of those giants stood a short, golden-robed Tamil. The Tamil had silver-streaked hair and an urbane expression.
What are we supposed to do? Kaltan whispered to Oskanya.
Act formal, Oskanya advised. Etons adore formality.
Ah, Norcan,
he said to the Tamil in the golden robe.
So good to see you again. Fontan sends his best.
How is the old rascal?
Oskanya's colleague replied.
Wrinkled, but he still hasn't lost his edge.
I'm glad to hear it. Why are we speaking in Alenic?
So that you can brief us all on local circumstances. How are things here?
Tense. Our children are a bit discontented. There's turmoil afoot. We send them to stamp it out, but it refuses to stay stamped. They resent that. You know how they are.
Oh, my, yes.
Has the Emperor's sister forgiven you yet?
Norcan sighed.
Afraid not, old boy. I'm quite resigned to spending the rest of my career here.
You know how the people at court like to carry tales. Whatever possessed you to make that remark? I'll grant you that Her Highness' feet are a bit oversized, but big-footed cow was sort of indiscreet, wouldn't you say?
I was drunk and a little out of sorts. Better to be here in Etan than in Mathirion trying to evade her attentions. I have no desire to become a member of the Imperial family, if it means that I'd have to trudge along behind her as she clumps about the palace.
Ah, well, what's on the agenda here?
Formality, official greetings, speeches, ceremonies, the usual nonsense.
Good. Our friends from the West are a bit unbridled at times. They're good at formality, though. It's when things become informal that they get into trouble. May I present the Queen of Alenia?
I thought you'd never ask.
Your Majesty, Oscania said, this is my old friend Norcan. He's the imperial representative here in Aton, an able man who's fallen on hard times.
Norcan bowed. Your Majesty, he greeted Aelana.
Your Excellency, she responded. Then she smiled. Are Her Highness' feet really that big?
She asked him slyly. She skis with only the equipment God gave her, Your Majesty. I could bear that, I suppose, but she's given to temper tantrums when she doesn't get her own way, and that sort of grates on my nerves.
He glanced at the huge, dark-cloaked Aetons surrounding the carriage.
Might I suggest that we proceed to what my children here refer to as the palace? The king and queen await us there. Is Your Majesty comfortable speaking in public? A few remarks might be in order.
I'm afraid I don't speak Tamil, Your Excellency.
Perfectly all right, Your Majesty. I'll translate for you. You can say anything that pops into your head. I'll tidy it up for you as we go along.
How very kind of you. There was only the faintest edge to her voice.
I live but to serve, Your Majesty.
Remarkable, Norcan, Oscania murmured. How do you manage to put both feet in your mouth at the same time?
It's a gift, Norcan shrugged.
King Andril of Aton was 7 feet tall, and his wife, Queen Betwana, was only slightly shorter. They were very imposing. They wore golden helmets instead of crowns, and their deep blue silk robes were open at the front, revealing the fact that they were both heavily armed. They met the Queen of Alenia and her entourage in the square outside the royal palace of Aton, which was in actuality nothing more than their private dwelling. Aton ceremonies, it appeared, were conducted out of doors. With the queen's carriage in the lead, and her armed escort formed up behind, the visitors rode at a slow and stately pace into the square. There were no cheers, no fanfares, none of the artificial enthusiasm normally contrived for state visitors. Aetons showed respect by silence and immobility. Stragan skillfully wheeled the carriage to a spot in front of the slightly raised stone platform before the royal dwelling, and Sparhawk dismounted to offer his queen a steel-encased forearm. Aelana's face was radiantly regal, and her pleasure was clearly unfeigned. Though she occasionally spoke slightingly of ceremonial functions, pretending to view them as tedious, she truly loved ceremony. She took a deep satisfaction in formality. Ambassador Oscania approached the royal family of Aton, bowed, and spoke at some length in the flowing musical language of all Tamils. Mirtai stood behind Aelana, murmuring a running translation of His Excellency's words. Aelana's eyes were very bright, and there were 2 spots of heightened color on her alabaster cheeks, signs that said louder than words that she was composing a speech. King Andril then spoke a rather brief greeting, and Queen Betwana added her somewhat lengthier agreement. Sparhawk could not hear Mirtai's translation, so for all he knew, the Aeton king and queen were discussing weather conditions on the moon. Then Aelana stepped forward, paused for dramatic effect, and began to speak in a clear voice that could be heard throughout the square. Ambassador Norcan stood at the side of the stone platform and translated her words.
My dear brother and sister of Aeton, she began, words cannot express my heartfelt joy at this meeting.
Sparhawk knew his wife, so he knew that disclaimer to be fraudulent. Words could express her feelings, and she would tell everybody in the square all about them.
I come to this happy meeting from the world's far end, she went on, and my heart was filled with anxiety as I sailed across the wine-dark sea toward a foreign land peopled with strangers. But your gracious words of friendly, even affectionate greeting, have erased my childish fears, and I have learned here a lesson which I will carry all the days of my life. There are no strangers in this world, my dear brother and sister. There are only friends we have not yet met.
She's plagiarizing,
Strakan murmured to Sparhawk.
She does that now and then. When she finds a phrase she really likes, she sees no reason not to expropriate it.
My journey to Eitan has been, of course, for state reasons. We of the royal houses of the world are not free to do things for personal reasons as others are.
She gave the Eitan king and queen a rueful little smile.
We cannot even yawn without its being subjected to extensive diplomatic analysis. No one ever considers the possibility that we might just be sleepy.
After Norcan translated that, King Andral actually smiled.
My visit to Eitan, however, does have a personal reason as well as an official one,
Elana continued.
I chanced some time ago upon a precious thing which belongs to the Eitan people, and I have come half round the world to return this treasure to you, though it is more dear to me than I can ever say. Many, many years ago, an Eitan child was lost. That child is the treasure of which I spoke. She reached out and took Mirtai's hand. She is my dear, dear friend, and I love her. The journey I have made here is as nothing. Gladly would I have traveled twice as far, 10 times as far, for the joy I now feel in reuniting this precious Eitan child with her people.
Strakan wiped at his eyes with the back of his hand.
She does it to me every time, Sparhawk, he laughed. Every single time. I think she could make rocks cry if she wanted to, and it always seems so simple.
That's part of her secret, Strakan.
Elana was moving right along. As many of you may know, the Aline people have some faults, many faults, though I blush to confess it. We have not treated your dear child well. An Aline bought her from the soulless Arjunai, who had stolen her from you. The Aline bought her in order to satisfy his unwholesome desires. This child of ours, for she is now as much my child as she is yours, taught him that an Eitana may not be used so. It was a hard lesson for him. He died in the learning of it.
A rumble of approval greeted the translation of that.
Our child has passed through the hands of several Alines, most with the worst of motives, and came at last to me. At first she frightened me.
Elana smiled her most winsome smile.
You may have noticed that I am not a very tall person.
A small chuckle ran through the crowd.
I thought you might have noticed that, she said, joining in their laughter. It's one of the failings of our culture that our menfolk are stubborn and short-sighted. I am not permitted to be trained in the use of weapons. I know it sounds ridiculous, but I've not even been allowed to kill my enemies personally. I was not accustomed to women who could see to their own defense, and so I was foolishly afraid of my Eitan child. That has passed, however. I have found her to be steadfast and true, gentle and affectionate, and very, very wise. We have come to Eitan so that this dear child of ours may lay aside the silver of childhood and assume the gold that is her just due in the rite of passage. Let us join our hands and our hearts, Eline and Eitan, Styrik and Tamil, in the ceremony which will raise our child to adulthood. And in that ceremony may our hearts be united, for in this child we are all made as one.
As Norcan translated, an approving murmur went through the crowd of Eitans, a murmur that swelled to a roar, and Queen Betwana, her eyes filled with tears, stepped down from the dais and embraced the pale blonde Queen of Alenia. Then she spoke very briefly to the crowd.
What did she say? Strakan asked Oscania.
She advised her people that anyone who offered your queen any impertinence would answer to her personally. It's no idle threat, either. Queen Betwana is one of the finest warriors in all of Eitan. I hope you appreciate your wife, Sparhawk. She's just scored a diplomatic coup of the highest order. How the deuce did she learn that the Eitans are sentimentalists? If she'd talked for another 3 minutes, the whole square would have been awash with tears.
Our queen's a perceptive young woman, Strakan said rather proudly. A good speech is always drawn on a community of interests. Our Elana's a genius when it comes to finding things she has in common with her audience.
So it would seem.
She's insured one thing, let me tell you.
Oh?
The Etans will give Etana Mirtai a rite of passage such as comes along only once or twice in a generation. She'll be a national heroine after an introduction like that. The singing will be tumultuous.
That's probably more or less what my wife had in mind, Sparhawk told him. She loves to do nice things for her friends.
And not so nice things to her enemies, Stragan added. I remember some of the plans she had for Primate Anias.
That's as it should be, my lord Stragan, Oscania smiled. The only real reasons for accepting the inconveniences of power are to reward our friends and punish our enemies.
I couldn't agree more, Your Excellency.
Angessa conferred with King Andril, and Aelana with Queen Betwana. No one was particularly surprised when Sephrenia served as translator for the queens. The small Styric woman, it appeared, spoke most of the languages in the known world. Norcan explained to Sparhawk and the others that the child's parents were much involved in the rite of passage. Angessa would serve as Mirtai's father, and Mirtai had rather shyly asked Aelana to be her mother. The request had occasioned an emotional display of affection between the two of them.
It's a rather touching ceremony, actually, Norcan told them. The parents are obliged to assert that their child is fit and ready to assume the responsibilities of adulthood. Then they offer to fight anyone who disagrees.
Not to worry, Sparhawk, he added with a chuckle. It's a formality. The challenge is almost never taken up.
Almost never? I'm teasing, of course. No one's going to fight your wife. That speech of hers totally disarmed them. They adore her. I hope she's quick of study, however. She'll have to speak in Tamil.
Learning a foreign language takes a long time, Carlton said dubiously. I studied Styric for 10 years and never did get the hang of it.
You have no aptitude for languages, Carlton, Vanyan told him. Even a Lenik confuses you sometimes.
You don't have to be insulting, Lord Vanyan.
I imagine Sephrenia will cheat a little, Sparhawk added. She and Afriel taught me to speak Troll in about 5 seconds in Gwerig's cave.
He looked at Norcan. When will the ceremony take place? He asked.
At midnight. The child passes into adulthood as one day passes into the next.
There's an exquisite kind of logic there, Stragan noted.
The hand of God, Bevier murmured piously.
I beg your pardon?
Even the heathen responds to that gentle inner voice, my lord Stragan.
I'm afraid I'm still missing the point, Sir Bevier.
Logic is what sets our god apart, Bevier explained patiently. It's his special gift to the Aline people, and he reaches out with it to all others, freely offering its blessing to the unenlightened.
Is that really a part of Aline doctrine, Your Grace?
Stragan asked the Patriarch of Usera.
Tentatively, Amban replied. The view is more widely held in Archaeum than elsewhere. The Archaean clergy has been trying to have it included in the Articles of the Faith for the last 1,000 years or so, but the Deerans have been resisting. The Hierocracy takes up the question when we have nothing else to do.
Do you think it will ever be resolved, Your Grace? Norcan asked him.
Good God, no, Your Excellency. If we ever settled the issue, we wouldn't have anything to argue about.
Oscania approached from the far side of the square. He took Sparhawk and Vanyan aside, his expression concerned.
How well do you gentlemen know Zelasta? He asked them.
I only met him once before we reached Sarsos, Sparhawk replied. Lord Vanyan here knows him much better than I.
I'm starting to have some doubts about this legendary wisdom of his, Oscania said to them. The Styric Enclave in Eastern Astel abuts Etam. So he should know more about these people than he seems to. I just caught him suggesting a demonstration of prowess to the Paloi and some of the younger church knights.
It's not unusual, Your Excellency, Vanyan shrugged. Young men like to show off.
That's exactly my point, Lord Vanyan.
Huskanya's expression was worried.
That's not done here in Etam. Demonstrations of that kind lead to bloodshed. The Etans look upon that sort of thing as a challenge. I got there just in time to avert a disaster. What was the man thinking of?
Styrics sometimes grow a bit vague, Vanyan explained. They can be profoundly absent-minded sometimes. I'll have Sophronia speak with him and remind him to pay attention.
Oh, there's something else, gentlemen. Oscania smiled. Don't let Sir Barrett wander around alone in the city. There are whole platoons of unmarried Eton girls lusting after him.
Barrett? Vanyan looked startled. It's happened before, Vanyan, Sparhawk told him. There's something about our young friend that drives young women wild. It has to do with his eyelashes, I think. Elana and Melodir tried to explain it to me in Darsus. I didn't understand what they were saying, but I took their word for it. What an astonishing thing, Vanyan said.
There were torches everywhere, and the faint, fragrant night breeze tossed their sooty orange flames like a field of fiery wheat. The rite of passage took place in a broad meadow outside the city. An ancient stone altar, adorned with wildflowers, stood between two broad oaks at the center of the meadow, and two bronze basin-like oil lamps flared, one on each end of the altar. A lone Eton with snowy hair stood atop the city wall, intently watching the light of the moon passing through a narrow horizontal aperture in one of the battlements and down the face of a nearby wall, which was marked at regular intervals with deeply scored lines. It was not the most precise way to determine the time, but if everyone agreed that the line of moonlight would reach a certain one of those scorings at midnight, precision was unimportant. As long as there was general agreement, it was midnight. The night was silent, except for the guttering of the torches and the sighing of the breeze in the dark forest surrounding the meadow. They waited as the silvery line of moonlight crept down the wall. Then the ancient Eton gave a signal, and a dozen trumpeters raised brazen horns to greet the new day and to signal the beginning of the rite that would end Mirtai's childhood. The Eton sang. There were no words, for this rite was too sacred for words. Their song began with a single, deep, rumbling male voice, swelling and rising as other voices joined it in soaring and complex harmonies. King Andril and Queen Betwana moved with stately pace and slow along a broad, torch-lit avenue toward the ageless trees and the flower-decked altar. Their bronze faces were serene, and their golden helmets gleamed in the torchlight. When they reached the altar, they turned, expectant. There was a pause while the torches flared, and the organ song of the Etons rose and swelled. Then the melody subsided into a tightly controlled hum, scarcely more than a whisper. And Gessa and Elana, both in deep blue robes, escorted Mirtai out of the shadows near the city wall. Mirtai was all in white, and her raven hair was unadorned. Her eyes were modestly downcast as her parents led her toward the altar. The song swelled again, with a different melody and a different counterpoint. "The approach of the child," Norcan murmured to Sparhawk and the others. The sophisticated, even cynical, Tommel's voice was respectful, almost awed, and his world-weary eyes glistened. Sparhawk felt a small tug on his hand, and he lifted his daughter so that she might better see. Mirtai and her family reached the altar and bowed to Andril and Betwana. The song sank to a whisper. And Gessa spoke to the king and queen of the Etons. His voice was loud and forceful. The Tommel tongue flowed musically from his lips as he declared his daughter fit. Then he turned, opened his robe, and drew his sword. He spoke again, and there was a note of challenge in his voice.
"What did he say?"
Talon whispered to Oscania.
"He offered to do violence to anyone who objected to his daughter's passage,"
Oscania replied. His voice was also profoundly respectful, even slightly choked with emotion. Then Elana spoke, also in Tommel. Her voice rang out like a silver trumpet, as she also declared that her child was fit and ready to assume her place as an adult.
"She wasn't supposed to say that last bit,"
Danae whispered in Sparhawk's ear.
"She's adding things."
"You know your mother," he smiled.
Then the Queen of Alenia turned to look at the assembled Etons, and her voice took on a flinty note of challenge as she also opened her robe
and drew a silver-hilted sword. Sparhawk was startled by the professional way she held it. Then Mirtai spoke to the king and queen.
"The child entreats passage,"
Norcan told them. King Andral spoke his reply, his voice loud and commanding, and his queen added her agreement. Then they too drew their swords and stepped forward to flank the child's parents, joining in their challenge. The song of the Aetons soared, and the trumpets added a brazen fanfare. Then the sound diminished again. Mirtai faced her people and drew her daggers. She spoke to them, and Sparhawk needed no translation. He knew that tone of voice. The song raised, triumphant, and the five at the altar turned to face the roughly chiseled stone block. In the center of the altar lay a black velvet cushion, and nestled on it, there was a plain gold circlet. The song swelled, and it echoed back from nearby mountains. And then, out of the velvet-black throat of night, a star fell. It was an incandescently brilliant white light streaking down across the sky. Down and down it arched, and then it exploded into a shower of brilliant sparks.
"Stop that!"
Sparhawk hissed to his daughter.
"I didn't do it," she protested. "I might have, but I didn't think of it. How did they do that?"
She sounded genuinely baffled. Then, as the glowing shards of the star drifted slowly toward the earth, filling the night with glowing sparks, the golden circlet on the altar rose unaided, drifting up like a ring of smoke. It hesitated as the Aetan song swelled with an aching kind of yearning, and then, like a gossamer cobweb, it settled on the head of the child. And when Mirtai turned with exultant face, she was a child no longer. The mountains rang back the joyous sound as the Aetons greeted her. Chapter 20. They know nothing of magic. Zelasta said it quite emphatically.
"That circlet didn't rise up into the air all by itself, Zelasta,"
Vanyan disagreed.
"And the arrival of the falling star at just exactly the right moment stretches the possibility of coincidence further than I'm willing to go."
"Chicanery of some kind, perhaps?" Patriarch Emban suggested. "There was a charlatan in Usera when I was a boy who was very good at that sort of thing. I'd be inclined to look for hidden wires and burning arrows."
They were gathered in the Paloi camp outside the city the following morning, puzzling over the spectacular conclusion of Mirtai's rite of passage.
"Why would they want to do something like that, Your Grace?" Khalad asked him.
"To make an impression, maybe. How would I know?"
"Who would they have been trying to impress?"
"Us, obviously."
"It doesn't seem to fit the Aetan character," Tinian said, frowning. "Would the Aetons cheapen a holy rite with that kind of gratuitous trickery, Ambassador Oskanya?"
The Tamil emissary shook his head.
"Totally out of the question, Sir Tinian. The rite is as central to their culture as a wedding or a funeral. They'd never demean it just to impress strangers. And it wasn't performed for our benefit. The ceremony was for Aetana Mirtai."
"Exactly," Khalad agreed. "And if there were hidden wires coming down from those tree branches, she'd have known they were there. They just wouldn't have done that to her. A cheap trick like that would have been an insult. And we all know how Aetons respond to insults."
"Norcan will be here in a little while," Oskanya told them. "He's been in Aeton for quite some time. I'm sure he'll be able to explain it."
"It cannot have been magic," Zelasta insisted.
It seemed very important to him for some reason. Sparhawk wondered if it had to do with the shaggy-browed magician's racial ego. So long as Styrix were the only people who could perform magic or instruct others in its use, they were unique in the world. If any other race could do the same thing, the Styrix's importance would be diminished.
"How long are we going to stay here?" Carlton asked. "This is a nervous kind of place. Some young knight or one of the Paloi is bound to make a mistake sooner or later. If somebody blunders into a deadly insult, I think all this good feeling will evaporate. We don't want to have to fight our way out of town."
nor can we'll be able to tell us,
Oscania replied.
We don't want to insult the Aetons by leaving too early, either.
How far is it from here to Mathurian, Oscania? Amban asked.
About 500 leagues.
Amban sighed.
Almost 2 more months, he lamented. I feel as if this journey's lasted for years.
You do look more fit, though, Your Grace, Bevier told him.
I don't want to look fit, Bevier. I want to look fat, lazy, and pampered. I want to be fat, lazy, and pampered. And I want a decent meal with lots of butter and gravy and delicacies and fine wines.
You did volunteer to come along, Your Grace, Sparhawk reminded him.
I must have been out of my mind.
Ambassador Norcan came across the Paloi campground with an amused expression on his face.
What's so funny? Oscania asked him.
I've been observing an exquisite dance, old boy, Norcan replied. I'd forgotten just how profoundly literal an Aline can be. Any number of Aetan girls have approached young Sir Barrett and expressed a burning interest in Western weaponry. They were obviously hoping for private lessons in some secluded place where he could demonstrate how he uses his equipment.
Norcan,
Oscania chided him. Did I say something wrong, old chap? I'm afraid my Alenic's a bit rusty. Anyway, Sir Barrett's arranged a demonstration for the entire group. He's just outside the city wall giving the whole bunch of them archery lessons.
We're going to have a talk with that boy, Carlton said to Sparhawk.
I've been told not to, Sparhawk said. My wife and the other ladies want to keep him innocent. It seems to satisfy some obscure need. He looked at Norcan. Maybe you can settle an argument for us, Your Excellency.
I'm good at peacekeeping, Sir Sparhawk. It's not as much fun as starting wars, but the Emperor prefers it.
What really happened last night, Ambassador Norcan? Vanyan asked him.
Aetana Mirtai became an adult.
Norcan shrugged.
You were there, Lord Vanyan. You saw everything I did.
Yes, I did. Now I'd like to have it explained. Did a star really fall at the height of the ceremony? And did the gold circlet really rise from the altar and settle itself on Mirtai's head?
Yes. Was there a problem with that?
Impossible, Zalasta exclaimed.
You could do it, couldn't you, learned one?
Yes, I suppose so. But I am Styrek.
And these are Aetons?
That's exactly my point.
We were also disturbed when we first encountered the phenomenon, Norcan told him. The Aetons are our cousins. So, unfortunately, are the Arjunai and the Tegans. We Tamils are a secular people, as you undoubtedly know. We have a pantheon of gods that we ignore, except on holidays. The Aetons only have one, and they won't even tell us what his name is. They can appeal to him in the same way you Styrek appeal to your gods, and he responds in the same fashion.
Zalasta's face suddenly went white.
Impossible, he said again in a choked voice. We'd have known. There are Aetons at Sarsos. We'd have felt them using magic.
But they don't do it at Sarsos, Zalasta, Norcan said patiently. They only use it here in Aeton, and only during their ceremonies.
That's absurd.
I wouldn't tell them you feel that way. They hold you Styrek in some contempt, you know. They find the notion of turning a god into a servant a bit impious.
Aetons have access to a god. And their god can do the same sort of things other gods do. They choose not to involve their god in everyday matters, so they only call on him during their religious ceremonies, weddings, funerals, rites of passage, and a few others. They can't understand your willingness to insult your gods by asking them to do things you really ought to do for yourselves.
He looked at Emban then, with a sly sort of grin.
It just occurred to me that your Aline god could probably do exactly the same thing. Have you ever thought of asking him, Your Grace?
Heresy, Bevier gasped.
Not really, Sir Knight. That word's used to describe somebody who strays from the teachings of his own faith. I'm not a member of the Aline faith, so my speculations can't really be heretical, can they?
He's got you there, Bevier, Uloth said. His logic's unassailable.
It raises some very interesting questions, Vanyan mused. It's entirely possible that the church blundered when she founded the militant orders. We may not have had to go outside our own faith for instruction in magic. If we'd asked him the right way, our own God might have given us the help we needed. He coughed a bit uncomfortably. I'll trust you, gentlemen, not to tell Sephrenia I came up with that. If I start suggesting that she's unnecessary, she might take it the wrong way.
Lord Vanyan, Amban said quite formally, as the representative of the church, I forbid you to continue this speculation. This is dangerous ground, and I want a ruling from Dolmont before we pursue the matter any further. And for God's sake, don't start experimenting.
Ah, Patriarch Amban, Vanyan reminded him rather mildly. I think that you're forgetting the fact that as the preceptor of the Pandion Order, my rank in the church is the same as yours. Technically speaking, you can't forbid me to do anything.
Sparhawk's the preceptor now.
Not until he's been confirmed by the hierocracy, Amban. I'm not trying to demean your authority, old boy, but let's observe the proprieties, shall we? It's the little things that keep us civilized when we're far from home.
Aren't Eileen's fun? Oscania said to Norcan.
I was just about to make the same observation myself.
They met with King Andril and Queen Betuana later that morning. Ambassador Oscania explained their mission in the flowing Tamil tongue.
He's skirting around your rather unique capabilities, Sparhawk, Sephrenia said quietly. A faint smile touched her lips. The Emperor's officials seem a little unwilling to admit that they're powerless and that they had to appeal for outside help.
Sparhawk nodded.
We've been through it before, he murmured. Oscania was very concerned about that when he spoke to us in Kyrellos. It seems a little short-sighted in this situation, though. The Etons make up the Tamil army. It doesn't really make much sense to keep secrets from them.
Whatever made you think that politics was supposed to make sense, Sparhawk?
I've missed you, little mother. He laughed.
I certainly hope so.
King Andril's face was grave, even stern, as Oscania described what they had discovered in Astel. Queen Betuana's expression was somewhat softer, largely because Danae was sitting in her lap. Sparhawk had seen his daughter do that many times. Whenever there was a potential for tension in a situation, Danae started looking for laps. People invariably responded to her unspoken appeals to be held, without even thinking about it.
She does that on purpose, doesn't she? He whispered to Sephrenia.
That went by a little fast, Sparhawk.
Afriel.
She climbs into people's laps in order to control them.
Of course. Close contact makes it far more certain. And subtle.
That's the reason she's always remained a child, isn't it? So that people will pick her up and hold her, and she can make them do what she wants.
Well, it's one of the reasons.
She won't be able to do that when she grows up, you know.
Yes. I do know, Sparhawk, and I'm going to be very interested to see how she handles the situation. Oscania's coming to the point now. He's asking Andril for a report on any incidents similar to the ones you've encountered.
Norcan stepped forward to translate for Andril, and Oscania retired to the Aline side of the room to perform the same service. The Tamils had perfected the tedious but necessary business of translation to make it as smooth and unobtrusive as possible. King Andril pondered the matter for a few moments. Then he smiled at Eilana and spoke to her in Tamil. His voice was very soft.
Thus says the king, Norcan began his translation. Gladly do we greet Eilana Queen once more, for her presence is like the sunshine come at last after a long winter.
Oh, that's very nice, Sephrenia murmured. We always seem to forget the poetic side of the Etan nature.
Moreover, Norcan continued his translation, glad are we to welcome the fabled warriors of the West and the wise man of Kyrellos Church.
Norcan was obviously translating verbatim. Amban politely inclined his head.
Clearly we see our common concern in the matter at hand, and staunchly will we join with the West warriors in such acts as are needful.
Andril spoke again, pausing from time to time for translation.
Our minds have been unquiet in seasons past, for we have failed in tasks set for us by our Matherian masters. This troubles us, for we are not accustomed to failure.
His expression was slightly mortified as he made that admission.
I am sure, Aelana Queen, that Oscania Emperor Speaker has told you of our difficulties in parts of Tamuli beyond our own borders. Shamed are we that he has spoken truly.
Queen Betwana said something briefly to her husband.
She told him to get on with it, Sephrenia murmured to Sparhawk. It appears that his tendency to be flowery irritates her. At least that was the impression I got.
Andril said something to Norcan in an apologetic tone.
That's a surprise, Norcan said, obviously speaking for himself now. The king just admitted that he's been keeping secrets from me. He doesn't usually do that.
Andril spoke again, and Norcan's translation became more colloquial, as the Aton king seemed to lay formality aside.
He says that there have been incidents here in Aton itself. It's an internal matter, so he technically wasn't obliged to tell me about it. He says they've encountered creatures he calls the Shaggy Ones. As I understand it, the creatures are even bigger than the tallest Aetons.
Long arms? Ruloth asked intently. Flat noses and big bones in the face? Pointed teeth?
Norcan translated into Tamil, and King Andril looked at Ruloth with some surprise. Then he nodded.
Trolls, Ruloth said. Ask him how many his people have seen at any one time.
50 or more, came the reply.
Ruloth shook his head.
That's very unlikely, he said flatly. You might find a single family of trolls working together, but never 50 all at once.
He wouldn't lie, Norcan insisted.
I didn't say he did, but trolls have never behaved that way before. If they had, they'd have driven us out of Thalesia.
It seems that the rules have changed, Ruloth, Tinian noted. Have there been any other incidents, Your Excellency? Things that didn't involve trolls?
Norcan spoke to the king, and then translated the reply. They've had encounters with warriors in strange armor, and with strange equipment.
Ask him if they might have been Sirgai, Bevier suggested. Horsehair-crested helmets, big round shields, long spears?
Norcan posed the question, though his expression was baffled. It was with some amazement that he translated the reply.
They were, he exclaimed. They were Sirgai. How's that possible?
We'll explain later, Sparhawk said tersely. Were there any others?
Norcan asked the questions quickly now, obviously excited by these revelations. Queen Betwana leaned forward slightly and took over for her husband.
Arjunai, Norcan said tersely. They were heavily armed and made no attempt to hide the way they usually do. And once there was an army of Alenes, mostly serfs.
Then his eyes went wide with astonishment.
That's totally impossible. That's only a myth.
My colleague's losing his grip, Oscania told them. The queen says that once they encountered the Shining Ones.
Who are they? Stragan asked.
Norcan's right, Oscania replied. The Shining Ones are mythical creatures. It's another of those things I told you about back in Kyrellos. Our enemy's been sifting through folklore for horrors. The Shining Ones are like vampires, werewolves, and ogres. Would Your Majesty object if Norcan and I pursued this, and then gave you a summary? He asked Aelana.
Go right ahead, Your Excellency, she agreed. The two Tamils began to speak more rapidly now, and Queen Betwana replied firmly. Sparhawk got the distinct impression that she was far more intelligent and forceful than her husband. Still holding Princess Danae in her lap, she answered the questions incisively, and her eyes were very intent.
Our enemy seems to be doing the same things here in Aton that he's been doing elsewhere, Oscania told them finally. And he's been adding a few twists besides. The forces from antiquity behave the same as your antique Lamorks did back in Eosia, and the way those Sirgai and their Senescan allies did in the forest west of Sarsos. They attack, there's a fight, and then they vanish when their leader gets killed. Only their dead remain. The trolls don't vanish.
They all have to be killed. What about these shining ones? Kaltan asked.
There's no way to be sure about those, Oskanya replied. The Etons flee from them.
They what? Stragan's voice was startled.
Everybody's afraid of the shining ones, my lord, Oskanya told him. The stories about them make tales of vampires and werewolves and ogres sound like bedtime stories.
Could you accept a slight amendment, Your Excellency? Uloth asked mildly. I don't want to alarm you, but ogres are real. We see them all the time in Thalesia.
You're joking, Sir Uloth.
No, not really.
Uloth took off his horned helmet.
These are ogre horns, he said, tapping the curved appurtenances on his headgear.
Maybe what you have in Thalesia is just a creature you call an ogre, Oskanya said dubiously.
12 feet tall, horns, fangs, claws for fingers. That's an ogre, isn't it?
Well,
that's what we've got in Thalesia. If they aren't ogres, we'll settle for them until you can find us some real ones.
Oskanya stared at him.
They aren't all that bad, Your Excellency. The trolls give us more trouble, probably because they're meat-eaters. Ogres eat anything. Actually, they prefer trees for dinner over people. They're particularly fond of maple trees for some reason, probably because they're sweet. A hungry ogre will kick his way right through your house to get at a maple tree you've got growing in your backyard.
Is he actually serious? Oskanya appealed to the others.
Uloth sometimes had that effect on people.
Tinian reached over and wrapped the ogre horns on Uloth's helmet with his knuckles.
These feel fairly serious to me, Your Excellency, he said. And that raises some other questions. If ogres are real, we might want to rethink our positions on vampires, werewolves, and these shining ones as well. Under the circumstances, we might consider discarding the word impossible for the time being.
But you are Mirtai, Princess Danae insisted.
It's a different kind of thing, Danae, the Etana told her. It's symbolic in my case.
Everything's symbolic, Mirtai, Danae told her. Everything we do means something else. There are symbols all around us. No matter how you want to look at it, though, we have the same mother, and that makes us sisters.
It seemed very important to her for some reason. Sparhawk was sitting with Sephrenia in the corner of a large room of King Andril's house. His daughter was busy asserting her kinship with Mirtai, as Baroness Melodir and Elana's maid looked on. Mirtai smiled gently. All right, Danae, she gave in. If you want to think so, we are sisters. Danae gave a little squeal of delight, jumped into Mirtai's arms, and smothered her with kisses.
Isn't she a little darling?
Baroness Melodir laughed.
Yes, Baroness,
Aileen murmured. Then a small frown creased the girl's brow.
I'll never understand that, she said. No matter how closely I watch her, she always manages to get her feet dirty.
She pointed at Danae's grass-stained feet.
Sometimes I almost think she's got a box full of grass hidden among her toys, and she shuffles her feet in it when my back's turned, just to torment me.
Melodir smiled.
She just likes to run barefoot, Aileen, she said. Don't you ever want to take off your shoes and run through the grass?
Aileen sighed.
I'm in service, Baroness, she replied. I'm not supposed to give in to that sort of whim.
You're so very proper, Aileen, the honey blonde Baroness said. If a girl doesn't give in to her whims now and then, she'll never have any fun.
I'm not here to have fun, Baroness. I'm here to serve. My first employer made that very clear to me.
She crossed the room to the two sisters and touched Danae's shoulder.
Time for your bath, Princess, she said.
Do I have to?
Yes.
It's such a bother. I'll just get dirty again, you know.
We're supposed to make an effort to stay ahead of it, Your Highness.
Do as she tells you, Danae, Mirtai said.
Yes, sister dear. Danae sighed.
End of side 8. Change side selector switch. This book is continued on the next cassette.